Welcome to the Source Refresh Small Business Supply Chain Podcast. I'm your host, Chandrika Venkatraman. Join me as I talk to small businesses from across the world to learn about their supply chains, their support systems, and what keeps them moving. Today, my guest on the Source Refresh Podcast is David Downing. David is the co-founder and CEO of Chipmunk Baking. They're a specialty baking business focused on creating low-carb, low-glycemic impact desserts. David has a background in accounting, having worked previously for professional service firms. David, happy to have you here on the show today. Will you please tell us a little bit more about Chipmunk Baking, your product lines, and where we can find your products?
Sure. Yeah, great to be here. So Chipmunk Baking, we specialize in low-carb, gluten-free cookies and cookie bites. Basically, 2019, we started the business because my co-founder, Jose Hernandez, has type 2 diabetes and could never really find a sweet treat that was satisfying for him. Everything either had really bad ingredients or just tasted pretty horrible. So he ended up making some himself. I, being his roommate and having kind of a business background, jumped on that, and we ended up on a four-year journey launching a business. In terms of our product lines, we call them keto cookies. It's like a single serve cookie, super low carb, 1 to 4 gram net carb. They're made with almond flour, and then they're sweetened with allulose and monk fruit instead of sugar. We have also what we call our keto cookie bites, which are basically smaller versions of those that come in a pouch. You get like a pouch of 8 bites. So that's more something to keep at home in your pantry versus the single cookies or a grab and go snack. We do have a high protein line of cookies as well. And then we sell our sweetener and our baking mixes if people want to do their own low carb baking at home. The easiest place to find us is our website, chipmunkbaking.com. We are also on Amazon, walmart.com, and then about a few hundred stores across the United States. Here in Texas, the biggest one is Central Market. We've got a store locator on our website too. So you can just type in your zip code and find whatever store is closest to you.
So your product lines include ingredients like konjac powder from overseas. Can you tell us a little bit about your sourcing approach for these international purchases?
Sure. So I think starting off, Jose and I had no background in food production, food science, baking, or anything like that. So when I initially was doing research on ingredients and where to find them, like most people, I would start on Google, like a Google search. And that'll usually get you there for the beginning, right? You can kind of type in the products, usually add the word bulk next to it and see if you can find like a 10 to 50 pound bag. And honestly, that'll get you for a while, because when you start looking for suppliers that specialize in distributing those types of products, they're usually gonna have pretty high minimum order quantities. Often it can be like a pallet or more. And for something like konjac root, where you're not really using a whole lot, you know, like for example, a pallet of that, it probably represents more than a year's worth of production for us. But I would say start online. And then what you'll probably find when you get that first order is sometimes it'll have the actual manufacturer's information on there. And so you can seek that out. You can also start to look for ingredient distributors in the United States. You know, another Google search is like specialty ingredient distributors in Texas. And then you can reach out to their sales team, ask for an ingredient list, and they can probably help you find what you're looking for. Another kind of interesting tool I came across recently is called Import Yeti. So it allows you to view import shipments into the United States, and you can actually like search and filter for certain terms like konjac. And then you can see what companies are importing those ingredients into the US, which is a great way to identify who is distributing those ingredients. Like they're probably buying them in bulk from Asia and then selling them to companies like you. You can also find other brands, maybe much larger brands, and they might be importing directly. But that's a good lead for you, because then you could, you know, reach out to that brand, hope they're friendly. A lot of them are, and see if they can maybe give you some advice. So that's how I would go about it, at least in the early stages.
You make it all sound so easy. But we know it's not, right? So small businesses may not have volume leverage, just like you pointed out. Add to that the complexity of, you know, rare ingredients like allulose, monk fruit extract, and you may find yourself with very few suppliers. Mm-hmm. How does a small business approach a situation like that? What's your strategy there?
I think, and this is something maybe I wish I had known upfront when we were creating our recipe or our formulas, is you can start by avoiding certain ingredients that only have the one supplier, right? Honestly, I probably would never use an ingredient if there were only one supplier, because it just creates such a massive risk for you. Because if that supplier goes away, or if they just decide they don't want to sell to you anymore, what do you do? Like, your business is kind of over. On top of that, I would just say my general philosophy is, with any ingredient that we have, always have a backup supplier, always have like up-to-date pricing and spec sheets from them, and have like a point of contact that you can call. And then once you have your secondary supplier, get a tertiary supplier and kind of keep track of that. So we're not super advanced, but we do have like a spreadsheet. It's like a master ingredient log. And for every single ingredient, it's like, here's our primary supplier, secondary, tertiary, contact info, pricing, when we last got the pricing. And I think that's a great thing you can do sort of in your downtime as a founder, is just like kind of build that out over time. And then once you have it built out, it's just sort of a continuous process as well. Like, always put your feelers out for finding people selling those ingredients and getting that pricing, adding them to your contact list. And then ideally over time, you're finding better pricing. You can even leverage pricing you get from one supplier to go back to your primary supplier and be like, hey, like, I just got this quote for allulose. It's 20% cheaper than what you're charging. Can you match it? And that can be a great tool to bring your cost of goods sold down over time.
All fantastic recommendations. You know, one thing that you decided early on was to build your own manufacturing capability. Mm-hmm. How did you make that decision?
Yeah, I think for a lot of food companies, you start off at home and then probably eventually in some sort of shared commercial kitchen space. And then you reach a point where, you know, maybe a grocery chain calls you and they want to order your stuff, and you just can't make it at that level in your facility. So you have two choices. You build out your own space where you can make it in mass, or you work with a contract manufacturer. Contract manufacturing, that's sort of where we thought we would go. So when we reached that point where I felt like the shared commercial kitchen space was just too much, like too tight, I started contacting contract manufacturers. And what I found is the costs involved are pretty tremendous for a small business. Usually there's a lot of upfront, like typically whatever your recipe is, it's not going to work, and they're going to need to work on it. They're going to add some stuff so it can go through their machines, or it has a shelf life, or X, Y, and Z. And that's not free. They're going to charge you for it. And then the minimum order for even just a single run can be in the tens of thousands of units, which, that's a huge gamble early on, because you're kind of rolling the dice. You're spending all this money on this big run of products, which you may or may not be able to sell. And honestly, it's probably not even going to be like your final formula. Like, like you're going to change it. And once you have 50,000 cookies, you can't change it, right? With your own facility, it kind of like flips that in a way where, yes, there's a big upfront investment, and more so than contract manufacturing, but it does give you the ability to be much more flexible and nimble, in the longer term. Because all of a sudden, you get to pick how much product you make in each run. You can choose to make 100 cookies if you want, or ideally, you can get to the 10,000 cookie mark as well. You'll probably not be as efficient as a big contract manufacturer, but you can certainly build it in a way where you're more efficient than in the shared kitchen. Yeah, it gives you that ability to do small batch runs. If you maybe identify something wrong or something you could improve in your recipe, you can do it really quickly. And for us too, it opens up ancillary revenue sources where we can sublease the space to other companies, like other local food businesses looking for a kitchen, or you can even make product on behalf of other companies too. So like, we do contract manufacturing ourselves now. For me, the decision really just came down to flexibility. And I think as an entrepreneur, when you're starting off, you don't know anything. I still don't know anything. But one of the best things you can do when you don't know is to keep your options open so that if you make a mistake, which you're going to do, you have another door you can go through. Like you haven't, it's not like you've gone down that one door and there's just an empty hallway with nowhere else to go. It's like, no, I've gone into a hallway and I've got 10 other doors. So if like things aren't looking good, I'll just go to the right. So that was sort of our decision-making process. It's not easy. Like I said, it costs a lot up front and I would recommend hire someone who knows what they're doing to help you build out the space. Otherwise you're going to waste a ton of time and money. And then managing the actual operation itself is going to take up a ton of your focus and energy. You've got to build a team. You've got to set up processes. You've got to make sure you've got all your food safety protocols in place, your quality control, organization. And for some people, that's just not what they want to do, right? Some people would rather be making sales calls or going to trade shows or maybe sitting behind a computer doing analysis. And so I think you have to ask yourself, if you're making that decision between contract manufacturing and self-manufacturing, is this something I would actually enjoy that would give me energy? And if so, go for it. If not, then it's totally okay to outsource it to someone else who hopefully does enjoy it.
So this is by far one of the more interesting takes on, the standard make versus buy decision. I liked a few things that you said. Typically the decision is made on capacity, capability. I like how you added, the fact that formulation tweaks, right, experimentation. That's a very critical aspect. So thank you for pointing that out. And I think it's also really critical, your last point, right? Is this something you would enjoy? Because you're absolutely right. Like running a facility is no joke, right? Setting it up, actually managing the show and the risk that comes with that. So that's a very good call out there. So just moving into something you just said, regarding making your facility available for co-packing, mm-hmm. right? So you guys recently announced that, and you also have experience with subleasing your facility in the past. Talk to us about how you evaluated these options. Is subleasing the right approach? Is letting it out for co-packing, for providing those? How did you come up with those options?
Sure. So typically when you build your own facility, hopefully the capacity of that facility is much greater than your need at the start, right? And so for us, when we first built out the space, we weren't using it. We had a lot of empty space. We weren't baking that frequently. And so the easiest kind of low-hanging fruit to improve your financials is to simply sublease some of the time and space in your facility to another company. They come in, you say like, hey, you can produce food during these hours when my team's not here. You can have a shelf over there. And you're going to pay me. We did it like a monthly rent kind of thing. Some companies will do it by the hour. I tried to make it as simple as possible. I was just like, here for this flat monthly fee, you get access, you get these times, you get this much space. That's it. I think it can be a beautiful thing if you find the right subtenants. But we've had some nightmares. We've accidentally had subtenants or allowed subtenants that turned out to be a little bit crazy. And, in those situations, you can end up losing money because they might refuse to pay you, or even worse, they might destroy your facility or damage something. And, some of the equipment we have is far more expensive than like even 6 months of rent for someone like this. But I think it's as long as you vet the people that are coming in and obviously have them get insurance and all that good stuff, it can be a great way to immediately improve your kind of cash flow. Because all of a sudden, like $5,000 a monthly rent could go down to just $2,000. If you do it in a smart enough way, you might even get your whole rent covered, honestly, because there's definitely a premium when it comes to offering space like this. because you basically can say like, hey, we have everything set up. We invested, you know, $200,000. You have to invest $0 and you could use it tomorrow. So they're going to be willing to pay higher than your market rent. I would say the problem that happens over time, though, is assuming your company is growing, you're going to run out of space. And or those companies that you're subleasing to, they might not be as efficiently using the space. So maybe it's a local baker and they make 100 muffins every day and they need 4 hours of time to do that. Well, you're looking at your production team. You're like, I could make 5,000 muffins in that time. And now I'm having to make this trade-off because I'm running out of hours in the day. And so I think that's where we started to de-emphasize the subleasing and then switch our focus to like, maybe we can make stuff on behalf of other people. Cause it's like, we're already making these products. We're already making very large runs of them. All we need to do is find people who are interested in those products. And hopefully it's as simple as just putting them in different packaging, or it could be like a slightly different formulation, but it's like, if your team's already up and running and they're doing the production run, you can add that in. Or, you know, like have them do it separately, but it just allows you to get more out of the space, if that makes sense. So I think first year, definitely immediately look for sublease opportunities. Second, third year, as you start to grow, then you can consider manufacturing for others. But I mean, best case scenario, your own brand is doing so great that you're just making a ton of that too. So that's another way. By the way, local farmers markets are an amazing place to find potential subtenants for your kitchen. Every single vendor that makes food at a farmers market, they're always looking for a place. Like their current place always sucks or they have no place. And so, I mean, just one weekend of walking the markets, you could probably find like five potential candidates to come in. Finding candidates that can actually pay, that's a different story, but yeah.
So what are some opportunities in procurement and supply chain that you wish you had solutions for?
I guess like going back to that sourcing question, like something like Konjac, like it would be nice if there were maybe more publicly available tools for finding things like that, a little more transparency, because it does seem with ingredients, especially when you're buying in bulk, you kind of have to find like supplier by supplier individually. You do this whole sort of dance and show with them where they're like, what do you need? Here's what we got. How much do you use? And it's just like, man, I just need the price and, you know, like lead times. And it just takes a while. And then who knows, like the next month, their pricing could completely change because, you know, there's like a war in Ukraine or something. And so like that data that you spent a bunch of time collecting is like no longer accurate. So I wish there were just some just like database like that where you could just type in like, I'm looking for allulose and here's where my company is located to calculate freight costs. Please just give me a list of all suppliers and then like what their pricing is, which I know there's some businesses that have kind of built things like that, but nothing that I've seen do a great job on maybe some of those harder to find specialty ingredients. Outside of that, I guess like, you know, just more automation, like freight, overseas shipping, that always seems to be really complicated too. There are better technology tools. Like we book all of our freight with like an online tool and that makes it easier. That's about it. I think something that would help me too is the kind of inventory tracking process as well. In your, like I say, if you're warehousing ingredients as a small business, like before you get to the point where you've got like some kind of ERP system where you scan everything by barcode and it tracks it, it's tough. Like, you know, I've got one half pallet of almond flour sitting in the warehouse and then a new one comes in. And it's like, how do you make sure that you arrange it all in a way that it's getting like the old stuff's getting pulled first and you're kind of keeping track of all the lot numbers and things like that. I think most businesses early on, it's all by paper or by sort of just like memorization or simple color coding systems. And, you know, I think finding tools to digitize that. We recently started implementing a tool called Food Ready, and it's actually like, it's all on your iPad or your phone, and you create like a series of checklists, and it has the ability to track inventory. And that seems to be helping a lot, because it's like when something comes in, you pull up your iPad and you say, here's the lot number, here's what we got, here's the supplier, the date, et cetera. And then during production, when they're doing their checklist saying like, what did I use? It'll say like, here, you know, it'll pull up, here's all the almond flour that you have on hand, like click the one that you used. And then it's kind of tracking it all together and creates this food safety trace as well. So that's helpful, but there's always like this weird balance, like where you're too small for automation to make a whole lot of sense. And then eventually you do get to the point where like you absolutely need it. But when you're in that middle ground, it's hard to know, like, is this worth the investment of money and time? Like that app costs $600 a month. That's not nothing. And there's also onboarding fees. And, you know, as a small business, like it can be hard to justify that, but eventually you need it, right? Like you have to have those things.
Absolutely. I mean, you're, again, just with your experience of actually living it, I've heard this from many of the other small businesses that I work with too, that, you know, the need for a reliable inventory management tool that a small business in this growth phase can actually use. So what are some exciting projects you have going on for 2023?
So 2023 for us, I guess like it's a little painful and exciting. I think what we've come to realize with the Chipmunk brand itself is like trying to grow your own brand, especially in specialty food where you're using like premium or specialty ingredients. It's very expensive and it's very difficult to grow beyond a certain point. Either e-commerce or brick and mortar distribution. It, from what I have learned, and I hope someone out there can prove me wrong, you just have to have a lot of money in like a war chest built up to be successful. Short of having like some just revolutionary product that, you know, is just game changing and nothing else is like that. But, you know, that's not the case for us. So, you know, I think we've had to come to the conclusion that we need to de-emphasize our brand and reemphasize just having a strong core business that is profitable and taking advantage of the assets that we have built. And those assets would be kind of our facility, our production know-how, our sourcing know-how, formulation, and applying that to other companies that need that help. I think in that post where I announced that we were doing more contract manufacturing, the image I used was, you know, for our Chipmunk brand for 3 years, it felt like we were pushing a stone uphill every day. Like we were making progress. We grew the brand. It was over $1 million in revenue, but it was hard. It cost a lot of money versus this contract manufacturing piece is like pushing a rock downhill because people are coming to us unbidden. We're not reaching out to them. They're reaching out to us, asking for this help, asking for these services. There's a lot of it that we don't do. It doesn't make sense, but there is some of it that is just a no-brainer, right? Like a company that's like, I need a protein cookie and I need 10,000 of them this month. It's like, well, we do that every single day. So yeah, let's do it for you too. And so that's sort of the exciting piece for us is building that side of the business out to create just a really strong, profitable core business. And then, you know, we'll come back and revisit the Chipmunk brand once we have sort of more resources and just stronger, more stable footing. The contract manufacturing piece, it's a lot of pressure and energy too. In a way, we're building like an entirely new business. And so I personally, like these past 2 months have been, feel like kind of on the edge of like burning out because it's just like, I've got to figure all this stuff out again. Like, you know, what's our process for tracking our clients' inventory and tracking efficiency? Like what the heck do you even charge for these services? All that takes some thought. And so it's taxing, but it's really exciting when you start to get it right and you start to realize how powerful it is to have you know, like a core set of accounts that once you have them set up, they're the ones that are out there growing their business. And all you have to do is keep providing them their products, you know, at a high quality, But it sort of organically grows with time. Like one of our accounts, they started in a region of Whole Foods, and they just got in nationwide to all the Whole Foods. And so now all of a sudden they need 5x more production from us. And I know that founder was working his butt off to make that happen, but we didn't do anything, right? Like all we had to do is make his product well, and now we get to grow kind of alongside him. So I think that's going to be exciting. It's just getting it set up front, making sure you don't screw up, and then hanging on for the growth. So that'll be 2023 for us.
Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you again, David, for talking to me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can get more information on today's episode in the show notes or at source-refresh.com/podcast. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the Source Refresh Small Business Supply Chain Podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from.